The Linux Link Tech Show is on. Your link to GNU Linux and the latest technology. 2 hours of insightful guests, tech info, and playful banter. Free software, free speech, open technology, and open mic.
I love it.
Now, live from the Linux Link Tech Show studios, here are your hosts, Dan, Alan, Pat, and Link. Link it up and take it away.
Another exciting episode of Linux and Tech Show. This is episode 235. Today is March 5th, 2008. Welcome, everybody.
Welcome.
Hey.
We got a full house tonight. We got a great guest. We've got Christian Neinfeld from the Digital Tipping Point. Christian, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much. It's good to be here.
Give us a rundown. What exactly is the Digital Tipping Point?
The Digital Tipping Point is a digital tipping point. We want it's a film about the culture of freedom in cyberspace. The tagline for our film is "Set One School Free." The plot of the film is whether we can move one public middle school to free software, and we use that basic plot to hang on a lot of themes to get newbies, Windows newbies, interested in free open source software and what it might mean for them.
So what's your role in the project? You're the main guy, obviously.
So I didn't totally hear your question, but who is on the project?
Yeah, like you're the main person behind it, right?
So I'm the producer, but as with any free open source software project, this is a free open source software project, and so it's like herding cats. You know, you can't. It's a community, and people do what the hell they want, when the hell they want, the way they want, and that's exactly the way it should be.
So how long have you been working on the project actively?
Since 2003, August 2003, a lot of things have really changed since we started working on the project. There was no YouTube when we started working on the project. There were just so many things that, you know, Munich had not yet announced that it was going to be moving over to free software when we started it. And so our goal has been to document as much of it as we can and make all of this footage available for anyone to rip, mix, burn, and do what they want to tell their own stories. See, because the community builds the code, debugs the code, markets the code, and distributes the code. And we view ourselves as part of an effort, a distributed effort, to market the code and distribute the code. We have 11 languages. We've been to 6 countries. In 3 continents. We've got 11 languages, and our goal is to provide people with the tools to be able to, because not everybody can travel and go to those different places and speak with the mayor of Munich and stuff like that. There's just no time for it all. So we're making all of our footage available with the hope that people will actually use this footage, and there are so many different movies that could be made out of this, and there's so many different ways that it could be that the video can be used. We want to show Windows newbies how free open source software is built by doing the same thing with a digital tipping point film. We're putting all of our source code up on the Internet Archive's digital tipping point video collection in modular form, small bits, usually not more than 4.51 minutes or so, for people to tag and do anything that they want with it.
It's pretty interesting. Are you going to have, like, one actual film where you edit all the different clips together, which whatever one you decide to include, or are you going to keep it all separate and open for anybody to use them as they please?
So we want to make one documentary out of it, at least, and we are planning to version the film so that, because we believe that, just like free open source software, it's going to get better with revisions, and that's the reason for us open sourcing it. There are a couple different reasons for us to choose this model. Number one is just simple practicality. There's no way that we would ever be able to have enough funds to justify building a film like this. I mean, creating a documentary film is extraordinarily expensive. I've already spent somewhere probably in the neighborhood of $100,000 on this film, just, you know, in terms of having me and Paul Donahue travel around. Paul Donahue was the primary camera guy for much of the footage in Europe and Brazil. And so there's no way that we would have been able to do any of this if we didn't use collaborative open source methods and free software. So what we're hoping to do in terms of completing the film, we would like to interest, let's say, 5 to 10 people to make video shorts using this footage and themselves, or whatever, however they want to do it. We want to interest 5 to 10 people to do, you know, 10 to 20 minute video shorts, and then we're going to stitch that together, and that's how we hope to complete the first film. If we can't get enough enough compositors, enough directors to come forward to make their video shorts, then we're just going to go forward and we're just going to, you know, proceed with the plot that I was talking about, Set One School Free.
Question for you. What format are you putting the video up on the Internet Archives?
So the Internet Archive, when we started this out, was only able to receive basically, you know, we are compressing it into two forms, actually, .mpg and .ogg. We wanted to use .ogg, even though there are some technical problems with some of it. We wanted to put it up there for Anodex Technologies. I don't know if you know of Anodex, but it's a project that was started in Australia by Sylvia Pfeiffer and others primarily in Australia. Anodex is an open source technology that allows tagging and indexing of continuous media. So think about Technorati for video and audio. Imagine being able to, every time Richard Stallman says Microsoft, that you want to, the community is going to be able to go ahead and tag that for all the video everywhere that it exists in the world, provided that a couple things happen, provided that it's an open format. And so we wanted to be able to have OGG technology up there, but we also wanted to be able to have the Internet Archives Digital Tipping Point video collection be able to actually play the video that we were putting up there. And for some reason, if we only put up OGG, it won't play the OGG Theora video. So we had to use .mpg. So they're both up there. They're both, unlike any other service that exists currently, it's possible to download the high-res portions, and then even though it's compressed video, you can use it for one, maybe two generations before you start experiencing some degradation. But ultimately, we're going to need to give away the raw.dv format, and what we're really trying to do right now is outreach to the community to help us come up with ways to distribute the raw.dv format. And that's a real big problem. If the whole world were like South Korea, it would not be a problem because their up and down speeds are such that they can tolerate that. But every 4.51 minutes of raw.dv is 1 gig. So you can see that, you know, we have 370 plus hours of decent high quality video. And you can see that you know, we figure that by the time we're done with our first film, we're probably going to need about 15 terabytes worth of storage.
Wow.
It's a lot of footage, 350 hours.
Yeah, it is. It's a lot. And the reason for that is that we capture the footage. Our goal is to access the tapes only once for a wide variety of reasons, just the time in going through it, the cost of going through it, the wear and tear on our professional tape deck, the wear and tear on the tapes. So what we do, we capture all the footage, we capture a tape, and let's say a 40-minute tape usually works out to 8.5 gigs. So let's just call it 9 gigs. Let's call it 10 gigs just for ease of math. So if you've got like 10 gigs, then we edit out, you know, anywhere between 20 to 50% depending on the tape, depending on if I've been asking a lot of stupid questions, depending on if it's Richard Stallman and he yawned into the camera as he's wont to do. Because, you know Richard, he just lets it all hang out. So we edit out things that, you know, for posterity purposes, you wouldn't really want to have images of Richard yawning. And so that we tend to edit down to about, let's say, 80% of the original. So now for every 4.51 minutes, you've got the original gig, plus you've got, let's say, 800 megabytes. Then we compress that down to .mpg, and that usually is about, let's call it, 67 to 70 megabytes. And then we compress it down to Ogg Theora, and that usually compresses down to, let's just call it 40 megabytes. So, you know, maybe that's additional 100 megabytes. So now you're looking at a gig plus 800 megs plus, let's say, 100 megs. So that's like 1.9 gigs for every 4.51 minutes. And in order to edit video in subsequent generations, you really need access to the raw .dv footage because there are problems with compression. You can copy .mpg files all day long and you'll have good quality, but as soon as you start to try to re-render it, you start losing things.
So what are you using to do all your editing?
So we're trying to use free open source software tools to do all our editing, again, for a couple of reasons. Number one, practical, because we want to scale up. I mean, it doesn't make sense, for example, to use non-free versioning tools to do, you know, versioning of a free open source software project. The same way, even though the non-free tools are somewhat better in terms of the user interface, we decided that we didn't want to go down that road because even though today, like, nearly all movies, like 95 to 98% of all movies that you see in the theater, they're rendered on Linux, but there's a lot of non-free tools that run on top of it. And, you need the non-free tools if you want to get just, you know, a lot of the kind of quality that is demanded of box office movies. But we decided that we were in a space where we're able to, number one, advance the knowledge base of the free tools. We want to build the community, get more people using these free tools. And the other thing is that we felt we would really be hamstrung if we started using non-free tools, because how can you go to the free open source software community and say, oh, look, here we've got this digital tipping point film about the cultural implications of the global shift to open source software. Oh, but by the way, you have to use non-free tools to do the editing. That just doesn't work for so many reasons, not the least of which is if you go and buy a Mac, you're plowing a lot of money into that Mac. And when you render, you basically have to walk away from a box. It's like 7 to 1 in terms of rendering hours for each hour. And so that means that, you know, for a simple hour's worth of rendering, you basically have to walk away from that box for the whole night while you're sleeping and let it render all night. No one's going to do that if they're plowing all kinds of money into a Mac with all of the software and so forth. But, you know, if people build Beowulf clusters, or there's just so many things that you can do with free open source software in terms of your hardware, that it really frees up people in the community to do whatever they want with this footage. And so that's why we've really been focusing on free tools. Now, the exact free tools that we're using, we're doing storyboard editing with Kino, and then we're doing the compositing with Cinelera, and we've also been playing with KDE and Live, which has a kind of a slightly nicer user interface. If you want to do storyboard editing with the .mpg files that are up on the Internet Archive, which you can find at archive.org/details/digital-tipping-point, no .com or anything like that on the end, just archive.org/details/digital-tipping-point, you can use AVI Demux for doing that storyboard editing of that. But again, you know, once you start rendering things, you're going to start losing integrity. So, but those are the tools that we're using. The other thing that's really cool is that Jonathan Grindstaff, who's one of our community members, has created a really cool tool chain that we call Jonathan's Video Glue. And they're just basically bash scripts that allow us to automate the capture, compression, and uploading of video to the Internet Archive. And you can just open your browser and Google from tape to archive. So the search string, again, is from tape to archive in quotes. And that probably will take you to the Digital Tipping Points DTP wiki, where you can see our tools and the really cool bash script that Jonathan Grindstaff wrote.
So just based on the sheer amount of video that you guys have collected and worked on, it sounds like you've talked to a ton of people.
Yeah, we've spoken to just about everyone in the free open source software community who matters. I mean, that's not entirely fair to say, I suppose. We weren't able to speak to a lot of the KDE guys yet. We haven't spoken to all the GNOME guys yet. But, you know, with the big names that, you know, most people, the most prominent names we've interviewed, we've got an upcoming interview with Bruce Perens. We have interviewed Eric Raymond. We've interviewed Richard several times. We've interviewed Richard in three different locations. He was very gracious with us. We've actually interviewed him at the school that we're using as the sort of the setting or plot for the film. The only person that we really haven't interviewed is Linus. And although we did interview Linus's so-called boss, Tim Witham, back when the Linux Foundation was still OSDL. But we do need to interview Jim Zemlin. I'm hopefully going to be interviewing Andrew Morton, like in April or May. We've interviewed Jimmy Wales. We've interviewed the mayor of Munich, the culture minister of Brazil, Gilberto Gil. So, yeah, we've interviewed a lot of really cool and interesting people, and that's really what we hope is our ultimate gift to the community, is to be able to access these interviews and put yourself in the scene with these people.
You know, if I could go back to right around when we first started this interview, you had given a brief sentence as to what the Digital Tipping Point was. Can you repeat that again? Because somehow I think I misunderstood it. What exactly is the Digital Tipping Point?
So what I said was that the Digital Tipping Point is a digital tipping point. We think that the Digital Tipping Point is one of the things that can help bring about a digital tipping point. The Digital Tipping Point actually is a film project, video project. It's got three basic different parts to it. First, we're going to create a library of fully forkable footage that we're going to be loading onto the Internet Archive's Digital Tipping Point video collection for anyone to rip, mix, burn. We're going to be then culling out, let's say, the best 5 to 10 hours of video. We're going to make that video available in raw.dv format, either on DVDs or hopefully by that time the cost of external hard drives will have come down such that we'll be able to put it on external hard drives and ship external hard drives around to people. Then what we're going to, so that'll be our movie in a box, the 5 to 10 hours. Then out of that movie in a box, what we're hoping to do is to coordinate the community to create version one of the film. Now the first version of the film we're going to call Buzz. We're following the versioning nomenclature from Debian, so that, you know, it's going to be Buzz, Rex, Bo, Ham, Slink, Woody, Potato, Sarge. I probably got those somewhat out of order, but the Debian people in the crowd will know it. So that's what we're hoping to do. We're hoping to really create an open source project about free software using open source collaborative tools to help people understand, that is Windows people and Mac people, help them understand how cool free open source software is, how cool community is, and to just get them playing with these tools.
Okay, somehow, I don't know what I was hearing. I heard something dealing with a middle school.
Right. So the that's the plot. The basic plot, the tagline of the film is set one school free. So the idea behind the digital tipping point is that free open source software is good enough for most people's uses. And so there's really not a need for many people to have to use Microsoft Windows or Apple non-free products if they don't want to. And we believe there's going to be a digital tipping point. We believe that there's going to be this sudden switch over to free open source software, and we're all about documenting it. But for a plot, the idea is that a film can't just be preachy. You can't just have all these talking heads up there talking about how cool free open source software is because no one's going to care. So happens that there's a public middle school near my home, and I'm actually not, we're not releasing the name of the school just yet. We're going to hold that back as a teaser until the end. But so there's this public middle school near my home where 75% of the students come from households below the federal poverty guidelines. It's located in San Francisco. I was walking by the school one day, and I noticed that they had started a new school administration there. So I asked the principal, I said, do you need computers? I can give you as many computers as you want because I have access to a lot of old used computers here in the San Francisco Bay Area. She said, yeah. So we built a GNU Linux Edge Ubuntu thin client lab, and now we've graduated. That was in 2004 that we started it. So now we have graduated last year our first eighth grade class whose primary exposure to computing on a day-to-day level is free open source software. The plot of the film is, can we move this whole school to free open source software, teacher, principal, students, and all? Because the idea is, if there's going to be this digital tipping point, well, let's just experiment and see if we can actually make a mini digital tipping point happen with one school. Hence the tagline, set one school free.
All right, I see. See, now you're killing us, because now we want to know the school and how it's going, but we're going to have to wait for the movie, aren't we?
I can't wait to see a rough cut of the film.
Yeah, well, you know, if you want to see a rough cut of the film, then the way to do that is to become a rough editor. This is a community film. It's about the community. It's built by the community, and we really, really big-time need rough editors. We really big-time need people to send us hard drives, external hard drives, preferably like a 500-gig hard drive. I will load video onto it. I'll send you the hard drive back. You get to be the person who does the first pass at editing, you know, this historically relevant footage. You send the hard drive back to me. I load it up onto the Internet Archive's Digital Tipping Point video collection. If the time ever comes where we can get the hard drive back to you, we'll be glad to do that. But otherwise, you would just, like, please consider it a donation to the Digital Tipping Point project. But the point is that we really need rough editors to use Kino is our tool of choice to go ahead and just you know, take out the coughing and the sneezing and the stupid questions and, you know, edit it and send it back to us, and we'll load it up onto the Internet Archive's Digital Tipping Point video collection.
See, you know, you're lucky, because if you had us doing that show and editing for you, you'd send us like 300 hours of video, and you get back 310 hours of video. We cut out nothing.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it is cutting out. It takes discipline, and you know, you have to just think of your other community members when you're editing. You know, just have pity on them. You know, you don't want to have them sitting through, you know, me asking my stupid rambling questions, and you don't want to have them sitting through watching Richard yawn or Eric Raymond try to move himself around on the... We actually shot Eric Raymond out by Ocean Beach, and he was sitting on this, like, wooden stump, you know, so there's some fidgeting around with that going on. You know, people don't want to watch that. And so this is a way, all you're doing is just cutting that out.
Yeah, you can get a 500 gig hard drive for like $110.
Yeah, $100. You can get a, at Newegg, if you go to newegg.com, and, I can give you the brand name to look for. It's called Phantom Drive, and you could snail mail it to my office at 580 California Street, Suite 1600, San Francisco 94104. And we have gotten donations. I want to put a plug in for Russell Osendriver. He's been slashed on it a couple of times talking about the ODF versus OOXML dispute that's going on right now in Geneva. There was the vote that just ended last week, and now, you know, there's going to be 30 days of voting as to whether Microsoft's closed so-called Office Open XML becomes an ISO standard. But so a guy by the name of Russell Osendriver of World Label has sent us three different 500 gig hard drives, and so we're real grateful for that. The type of drive is called a Phantom Drive, or Phantom Drives, spelled F-A-N-T-O-M drives, and the type or the model is a TFD, that's like Tom, Frank, David, 500U16 drive. And, you know, with the rebate, it's only $99. It's a USB external hard drive, and we'll load it up with this raw DV footage. You know what our real goal is for the long term? It's actually pretty exciting. We want to establish actual community centers in various different cities around the world. Imagine that. I mean, as the cost of storage continues to drop, it becomes really pretty doable to have, let's say, a 10 terabyte RAID array. And, you know, imagine that. I think movie theaters are going to totally change. So what's going to happen is people are going to come into movie theaters. There's going to be rooms where it's going to be broken down into smaller rooms. People will be able to access, you know, raw.dv video, and they'll be editing it, and then they can invite their friends over by text messaging, and, you know, they can display their own movies that they edit, you know, right there in these small rooms. And I think that it's something where we could have, if we had people collaborating on free open source video the way they collaborate on free open source software, I think it would really be feasible for us to get over the hump of being ignored by the mainstream media, I mean, at least for the short term, and we can start making our own videos about our own lives, and, you know, we can have fun and invite friends and, you know, make lots of different exciting movies about that. And so what I'd like to do eventually is donate this raw.dv video to centers like that all across the globe.
It's a real interesting concept you're going for.
Yeah, I mean, it's very distributed. It's very disruptive. Disruptive meaning that there's no existing business model for it right now. But, you know, there was no existing business model for Google at one time either. And the thing is that as bandwidth continues to drop and the cost of storage continues to drop, you know, people are going to start editing in their browsers. I mean, you already can with Jump Cut and iSpot. You know, and people are going to get really used to this because people are going to, you know, increasingly, especially like with Skype and Gizmo and Wango Phone, you know, and Grand Central and, you know, all these other different, the Internet is basically just swallowing everything. It's swallowing TV. It's swallowing radio. It's going to swallow the production of movies. And right now, in 2008, it might seem a little bit absurd to talk about people being able to make feature-length films, but look at how many people put videos up onto YouTube, and as the cost of storage continues to drop, and more people get used to using video editing tools, it's going to get a lot easier for people to make these kinds of contributions.
And that's just now. You're getting not only professionals contributing to this, but I would assume you're also getting like students and everything making little videos and stuff.
This would be our goal. We haven't been able to actually. There's only one video segment up on the Internet Archive's Digital Tipping Point video collection that is from a camera not owned by a Digital Tipping Point camera person. There was I don't know if you remember this video produced by a woman by the name of Kina Granis. She had this cute little video that made the front page of Dig. The name of the song was "You Gotta Dig," and it's just this video of her sitting there playing her guitar, and she starts out singing it, and then at some point her two sisters pop up in the background. Did you guys see this?
I think I might have.
Yeah, I mean she's a really cute woman, and it's a funny little song about the obsession for digging, but. And that was actually kind of difficult for us to do, relatively speaking, because, it was all point-to-point. I had to email her. I had to ask her for the video. She had to send me the video, and, of course, she captured the video with her Mac computer, and so, of course, it was in a non-free format, and so I had to reformat it and then, load it up onto the Internet Archive's Digital Tipping Point video collection. And one of the things that's really stopping us or slowing us down is just how heavyweight video is. And so this is really an appeal to all the software developers who might be listening to the show. Help us come up with a way to have contributions of video the way people make contributions of code. Now, it's the kind of the cool thing is that as long as everybody has the same raw.dv source base, then you can use XML to edit that, because the XML edits they're just tags and it's really lightweight. So, you can edit 20 minutes of video. And the edit file is only a couple of kilobytes because it's just XML tags. And that's the kind of thing now that you could ship around the Internet. So let's get back to this idea of community raid arrays, where people are contributing this heavyweight video. As long as the path is the same in each of those our repositories, it would be possible to just ship around your actual edit by email. And that's really kind of something that's very exciting for us, is the prospect that someday, once we get this all down, we'll have these, like I say, these community centers, or just some way of actually sharing this, like 8 to 10 to 15 terabytes of storage, and we'll have the raw video available all around the world. People can go in there, they can copy, take some off onto an external hard drive, go back and edit it. And as long as they maintain that same path, and as long as, they use the same free open source software tools and create these XML tags, it's really possible for us to share these edits so that, we can improve it and send it back and forth easily via email, and or even like post it up onto a wiki. You could post your edits up onto a wiki and then just go and grab it down off there, so you don't have just point-to-point communication. It's really pretty exciting. But we don't really have that kind of infrastructure built yet, and this is one of the things that we're hoping to do with the Digital Tipping Point, as we get more attention and as we get more buzz and excitement and more involvement with more developers.
Christian, have you had a chance to see Revolution OS? Someone in the IRC was asking what your thoughts were on that film.
Yeah, and my apologies to the people in IRC. I mean, I've got the scroll going here, but I haven't been watching it, so my apologies. But thanks for bringing that up. Revolution OS is a good film. It was actually shot on film, and Justin, or is it Jason? Jason, forgot his last name.
Moore.
Jason Moore plowed a lot of money into it, and Larry Augustine, actually, whose office is right up the street from 580 California, he plowed a lot of money into it, and it was a really good film. And but, you know, I'm sure that there are a lot of people who have watched the film who have said, oh, gee, you know, I'd like to do something just a little bit different here or a little bit different there. And imagine if you could do that. I mean, Revolution OS was really important because it was, you know, a very early, very prominent, at least in the free open source software community, effort. And it, you know, probably even made it out beyond the free open source software community somewhat. So it was a really important early effort, but it was all shot on film. As far as I know, Jason has not released it under a Creative Commons attribute or any kind of Creative Commons license. And
yeah, we interviewed him a while back.
Yeah, and it's you know, I don't begrudge him that at all. I think everybody should be able to choose whatever licenses they want. I mean, of course, I want to encourage people to give it to the community. And, you know, our video is being released under a Creative Commons Attribute Sharealike license because we basically wanted to just, again, the digital tipping point is a digital tipping point. We're trying to encourage people to use video to explain to Windows newbies how it is that free open source is cool and what it is that you can do with it and so forth. And so the licensing thing is a part of the whole process. And, you know, Jason Moore just could not have done this at the time that he did simply because the processing speed wasn't there, the memory wasn't there. You know, he would have had to go and purchase a minor render farm. And he shot on film, and the thing about film versus video is that he was using higher quality cameras, and, you know, all of our work is done on broadcast quality cameras, the same kind of cameras that are used in most cases for pornography. It's a Sony PD-170 camera. It's a decent camera. But it's not as good as Jason Moore's cameras. But see, then the thing is, now Jason Moore has this huge cost structure that he has to go make back. I don't know how much money he spent on it, but when you're using film, I mean, film is extraordinarily expensive, and you know, I'm sure that he spent easily 10 times what I will end up spending on this film.
It's also a lot harder to do editing with. You need like a real, real professional quality editing station to do that sort of thing, right?
Yeah, everything from soup to nuts is more difficult when you're talking about film. And, you know, this is exactly the point. The digital tipping point is a digital tipping point, and the point is that Jason Moore did what he did back then because, number one, he wanted to make a tool choice, but number two, he didn't really have any other alternatives. But number three, look at how much money he had to spend. Look at what a different world it is today. I mean, certainly, you know, I mean, YouTube didn't even exist until, 2005, and you know, so there's certainly no way that Jason Moore could have foreseen what would happen then. But you know, we started shooting just in 2003, and already we were starting to see some. I mean, I knew that something like YouTube was going to happen, and so from the very, very beginning, I wanted to make this video available so that we could rip and mix and burn it as a community, which something that just was not available for Jason Moore at that time. Just the cost structure were too prohibitive. It's all about taking back the media is really what it's about. I mean, we interviewed Dan Gilmore, who created the phrase distributed journalism, and really the digital tipping point is an example of distributed journalism. It's what will happen. You know, Doc Searle said in his Digital Tipping Point interview that open source is what happens when the demand side supplies itself. And, you know, we're taking back the mainstream media. They have ignored us. Well, fuck them. You know, if we're not interesting to them, you know, well, we'll just go build our own infrastructure like the YouTube guys did, and you know, we're going to totally route around them. You know, the internet routes around all obstacles, and free open source software routes around obstacles, and we're going to route around these obstacles. But in order to do a good job, we really need to have participation by the community.
You got an awesome attitude. I like that. You know, if somebody gets in your way, just roll right over them.
Well, I like to say go around them, because whoever it is that you're rolling over, they actually might come and join you later. They might try to come and join you later. And just like Microsoft is trying to be oh so very open today, but you know, I know that none of us believe that. But the point is that, yeah, I mean, it's, you know, Jack Messman, the CEO of Novell, said in his Digital Tipping Point interview, he said that open source is like a flood. The floodwaters are always rising, and, you know, there will always be proprietary software. And I don't entirely agree with Richard. I really admire Richard. He's one of my heroes, and you know, we reference Richard and his work and his Four Freedoms, you know, whenever we can. But the, you know, there's always going to be this area of development of proprietary software, but we're always going to be behind them, chasing them and challenging them, and we're going to be shortening their revenue cycles. We're going to be shortening their innovation and development cycles, and we're going to be accelerating their end-of-life cycles. And once they end-of-life it, you know, more and more of these proprietary projects are going to need to open source it, because they're just not going to be able to maintain it, as Martin Fink wrote in his book, The Business and Economics of Linux and Open Source. You know, Martin Fink being a Hewlett-Packard vice president. I mean, that just, as the old saying goes, you know, you can't beat the open source community. There's just too many of us. We're too smart. We're everywhere, and we're coming up with all kinds of new ideas.
Okay, a couple of quick questions for you. Early off in the interview, you mentioned that you have like $100,000 invested in this thing already.
Yeah.
My question is that like personal money that you invested in, or do you actually have a group of investors that have contributed to the project?
No, I just dumped my own money into this, because I thought that I was a little bit worried about Palladium. You all remember before we started talking about DRM, we were talking about the buzzword was Palladium. I was really concerned that closed proprietary formats were going to, you know, basically close our culture down. And so I said, okay, I've got to try to do this. I've got to try to, somehow the money is going to come back. I just felt as though, you know, I eventually I'm going to be able to pay off my creditors. What I did was really financially risky. I just went and sunk a lot of money into doing this I'm a lawyer. I have no experience in making a film. This is the very first film of any type that I've done, and you know, basically my entire adult life has been about leveling the playing field, and so this was really, that's my law practice, and that's really what I'm attempting to do with this video project. But no, we have no investors yet. We are looking for investors. They probably would have to be angel investors. I mean, we do have an idea for how we're going to monetize it, but you know, let's face it, content, the cost of producing content is still astronomical, and there is a glut of content out there. Doc Searles hates it when we say content. He wants to talk about conversations, and that there's a glut of conversations out there, but, you know, what is it, every day there's like 100,000 new videos loaded up onto YouTube, and theaters are standing empty. You know, the big Hollywood studios are plowing hundreds of millions of dollars into films, even with, you know, brand name stars. And people are just not going to movie theaters the way they were before. Basically, anything that can get digitized, from books to newspapers to slick glossy magazines to movies to music, all of it is facing the gaping maw of the internet. And the internet's just basically going to swallow it. It's really taking all of this, all of these business models back to before recording started. You know, before recording started, recording was not always a business model for music, certainly. You know, for thousands and thousands of years, people have played music, and it was a, you know, it was like a one-time or roving, traveling performance experience. During the brief period of time, let's say maybe from the end of the Second World War up through maybe the release of BitTorrent technologies or Napster, up until that time, it was possible to make money by recording your intellectual property. I know Richard hates that word, intellectual property, but for lack of anything better, I'll use it. Intellectual property. You could record your intellectual property, and you could sell it because the cost of copying it and distributing it was prohibitive for the average person. But now you've got, you know, 100 million monkeys out there copying everything and giving out and loading everything up to BitTorrent and distributing it for free as in beer on the internet. And that's fundamentally changed the business model for everything, including the digital tipping point film. The only difference is that we sort of saw it coming. I mean, I don't want to brag too much, but, you know, I was able to see this coming, and I was able to say, okay, you know, we've got... It's sort of like, have you ever read this book by Cory Doctorow? It's called Down and Out in the Magic Kingdom.
I've read snippets of it.
So it's a really good book, and I think, you know, everybody who wants to know what the future is going to look like should read this book by Cory Doctorow. And coincidentally, Cory Doctorow is a genius, and he releases all of his work under, you know, you can, I think it's a Creative Commons, non-commercial, no derivs license, but at any rate, it's certainly free as in beer. And he makes money by selling these books because it's good and people like to hold books and so forth. But Down and Out in the Magic Kingdom is about, you know, basically a hacker, not cracker, a hacker, you know, in Richard Solomon's sense of the word hacker, you know, set sometime, let's say, 20, 30 years in the future, and a couple of things have happened. Number one, free open source software is everywhere. Number two, we have solved the problem of the energy-matter conversion. And number three, as a result of having solved that basic physics problem, we also have limitless, clean, non-polluting, non-greenhouse energy. And so what happens is that and we also have like nearly infinitely dense storage, and so at the end of every day, basically, people go up to a terminal that's in their home or anywhere else on the street. They put their hand on it, on a terminal, and they basically upload their memories and experiences for that day so that in case they trip and fall, get hit by a bus or something like that, they can be reborn from their basically, their body is recreated because of the matter, energy, energy, matter conversion, and they just download that person's entire life memories, you know, and just load it back up into your wetware, into your brain, and, you know, you can be born again, you know, as long as they catch you in time. And the thing that's really interesting about that is it really kind of talks about what it is that is possible using free open source software. You know, what are the limits? What's the end game for free open source software? We really can't imagine it when you start thinking about all of the various different things that are possible. But for the short term, there's just so much content out there. The question is, how are you going to stand above the crowd? So you may have heard the term woofy, right? Have you heard the term woofy?
No.
Woofy is term that Cory Doctorow coined in that book. I think we're moving to a reputation and attention-based economy, so that today's economy, the reason that people work is they want to be able to have a nice home, they want to be able to have a nice car, they want to be able to, you know, attractive girlfriends, boyfriends, whatever. They want to self-actualize themselves. They want to do what is really important to them. You know, and so this is Linus's point. You know, I mean, Linus is happy. You know, people ask Linus all the time, well, you know, you could have made billions by selling this. And he always gets honked off at that question because he's like, you know, I've got a decent job. I've got three beautiful girls. I love my wife. I've got a cool job. I get to drive around my Z Roadster, whatever, you know, his BMW Roadster. He's happy. What more does he need? You know, he doesn't really need Bill Gates' money. And the thing is that, you know, he's probably rich in a sense that Bill Gates is not. He's rich in the woofy sense. He's rich in the sense that's going to increasingly matter in the future. And, I mean, we're already seeing this woofy or attention-based economy where, you know, the books that do really well on Amazon are the books that get highly rated by other users. You know, the articles that do really well in Wikipedia are the articles that get the respect of other Wikipedia editors. The articles that make the front page of Slashdot or Dig, you know, are articles that are, you know, usually offered by, in the case of Dig, the top diggers, or, you know, the articles themselves are good. And so we're starting to see this shift where what you do on a day-to-day basis to make yourself happy and fulfill yourself is really all based not on how much money you have, but how much woofy you have. So woofy is spelled W-H-U-F-F-I-E, woofy. And so the name of the book is Down and Out in the Magic Kingdom.
Yeah, we spoke to Corey in the past. He's absolutely a great guest.
Yeah, he, you know, and Corey also, he, I don't know how much time do we have left?
An hour.
At least another hour.
Oh, that's cool. We have at least another hour. I don't know if I spelled Corey Doctorow's name. I don't know if there are two R's in Doctorow, whatever.
I think we know who he is.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, I mean, Corey's famous, one of his famous statements is that open source is like sheep that shit grass. You know, I mean, if you think about that. So we interviewed a guy by the name of Steve Weber. Steve Weber is great. We've got his, unfortunately, this indicates sort of the limit of free open source methodologies. We goofed up when we shot Steve Weber because I don't know what Paul was thinking of Paul Donahue. I'm not saying anything bad about Paul because, I mean, he's human. He's like the rest of us. None of us are perfect, right? And, you know, when you can't control everything. So we go into Steve Weber's office. He's this big deal poli-sci professor at UC Berkeley, and he wrote the book, The Success of Open Source. And The Success of Open Source. And you've got to interview him because he's really great. He created this phrase, anti-rivalrous goods. And the thing that's really interesting about that is that it shows why what we're doing is so important, because we really are transforming the whole economy. Because if everything is moving toward, and Chris Anderson actually has a book that he's going to be doing and an article that he did in Wired, the name of the book is just Free, right? And so the thing is that as more and more goods or value or services can be digitized, that means that more and more and more of the cost of producing and distributing those goods and services is going to drop towards zero, right? And so who are the people who are going to become most important in our society? They're going to be the people who have a lot of woofy. Now, currently you can buy woofy. You can buy woofy with money, you know, because Bill Gates, frankly, has gone out and he has spent a lot of money to try to get woofy, and he's gotten a lot of woofy with a lot of people. He's fooled a lot of people with this Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, which is the most dangerous thing in the world for free open source software, because it really gets right in the way of us reaching the people who matter most to us and the people for whom we the free open source software community matter the most. So along these lines, it's there's this guy by the name of Clayton Christensen, and he created the phrase disruptive innovation, right? So he basically tracked about how innovation changes come into the market, and he said that if you look at most changes that have resulted in sudden and dramatic shifts in business models, they have been this so-called disruptive innovation. They usually start in the bottom, like Google search is a disruptive innovation. Microsoft Windows is a disruptive innovation. Microsoft Windows disrupted Apple. It disrupted heavy metal, right? And in each case, when it started out, it really wasn't as good as what it was disrupting. And so the market leader doesn't squash it and can't really squash it and can't really kill it. And but the point is why this is all getting back to Woofy, and this is all getting back to the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, why they're so dangerous, because the people who really for the time being are most important to free open source software are like the school that we are supporting here with our local Linux user group in San Francisco, SFLUG. This public middle school, 75% of the kids live below federal poverty guidelines. Of the total 100% of the school, 65% of the kids are African American, 17% are Latino, 10% are Asian, 8% are Caucasian. And the thing is that they're what Clayton Christensen would refer to as overshot customers. They really either can't afford or won't afford. It's just like really not practical for them to go out and buy, you know, Mac, Apple products because, you know, they just don't have the money for it. But Steve Weber said that genius is randomly distributed throughout the human population. And the thing is that if we don't stop ignoring people who are poor, we're really going to do ourselves a disservice, because many of these people who are poor in the sense of cash poor, but maybe not poor in the sense of woofy poor, if we don't stop ignoring them, we're really doing ourselves a disservice, because these people may, you know, cure cancer, they may solve global warming. And so the thing that's so dangerous to me about the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation is that it's getting into those areas in the developing world where there's a natural marriage for free open source software. So I sort of have ranted a little bit. I should stop.
It's okay to rant. That's what we're here for.
Oh, cool.
We rant quite a bit on this show, as a matter of fact. But now, the second question that I had for you was... And this goes right back to that school. I absolutely love the idea of providing, you know, kids with Linux and kids with computers and stuff like that. And in particular, our group of show hosts have been instrumental in doing some of that to some extent on previous projects. However, what I'm interested in is how you approach this school to do, you know, to open up towards open source and Linux and stuff like that in their labs. And did you document the process, and is it somewhere where, you know, the community can access that so that, you know, maybe we can sort of use that information as we go along? You know, maybe there are some other people who have, you know, some influence in some school districts that can do that as well.
So we did document some of it. The school, by the way, I'm seeing on the IRC that some people are complaining about sound, and so I'm going to try to hold the speaker a little bit closer to my mouth. My apologies for problems with sound. The school is really very interesting. The school happened to test number one last year out of all public middle schools in San Francisco, despite the fact the demographics that I was talking about earlier, and coincidentally also this school actively seeks out students who are, you know, problematic students. It, unlike many schools, like private schools, where they seek out either parents who are wealthy or they seek out kids who are already scoring high, this school actually seeks out kids who are performing poorly. The kids start school every day. They have to be in their chairs doing their homework at 7:30 in the morning, and they stay at school until 4:50 in the afternoon every single day except for Friday when they get out at 2. This is a very intense school. The teachers work basically 12-hour days because the teachers are there from, like, you know, 5 minutes till 7 in the morning, and they often stay there until, you know, let's say 6 o'clock at night, and then they'll take an hour or two of phone calls from the kids at night every night. The kids are free to call the teachers up with questions, and they're expected to call the teachers up at home with questions. The kids all have the teacher's cell phones, and so your question was, did we document it, and do we have the footage available for people to rip Mixburn, and can it be replicated elsewhere?
Right, not even just footage. I mean, because I know that you want to include that sort of thing in your movie, in your film. But, I mean, is it documented? Is it, you know, documented in writing somewhere where, you know, we can, you know, other people can start taking advantage of your approach and things like that, you know? Story.
No, so I haven't done that yet, but I'm actually Googling. I submitted something to Slashdot and made the front page, so I'm just Googling Slashdot. Let me see. It's Microsoft inadvertently funds FOSS. So in California, so I did write something in my Slashdot journal, and I submitted it to Slashdot, and the editors put it up. I'm going to paste it into the IRC link here. So in California was sued. There we go. Let me see if that went through. Let's see. There it is. Yeah. So California sued Microsoft for antitrust violations. The Microsoft settled. And as part of the settlement, they agreed to pay X number of dollars per student per year for every school district in California. And so the link that someone wants to know, how did I do this without a SWAT team dropping in? That's funny. California. So the thing is that Microsoft was supposed to pay X number of dollars per student per school district. And we took advantage of that, and we went and we bought a server and two video-capable boxes and a couple of other things for and fortunately, it all had free open-source software on it because I spent a lot of time working with the principal and working with the administrators to try to do this. But in terms – your question is about documentation. Do I have any written documentation? No, not really anything other than what I just posted to the IRC channel, merely because it's, you know, there's so much work that's involved with the Digital Tipping Point film. And unfortunately, right now, I am still the single point of failure for the Digital Tipping Point film, which is something that I would really very much like to change, because I, number one, don't have the talents to be the single point of failure. I don't have the energy to be the single point of failure. You know, I'm really not that smart. I'm not that articulate. I'm not that good at any of the things that really requires the Digital Tipping Point to succeed. So I'm really waiting for, you know, someone to come in and say, "Hey, Christian, you're stupid. I can do this better than you." And I'm going to say, "That's cool. Let's see what you can do with it." But that means that I've been very, very busy. So I do a lot of community outreach. I do a lot of organizing. I spend a lot of time talking to people. I'm also doing a lot on the ground in San Francisco to sort of to sort of create the plot of the film as I go along, because it's, you know, so when you see the film by Michael Moore, the last film that he did called Sicko, where he goes to Cuba. I mean, that was obviously, that whole thing was staged, and obviously Michael Moore did that to make a point, which is, well, let's find the one place in the United States where there is universal free health care, and, well, it happens to be Guantanamo Bay, you know, in Cuba. So a lot of filmmakers will do this. They'll say, okay, we want to make a point. It's a documentary, and so a lot of it is unrehearsed. With a documentary, you just have to shoot and shoot and shoot and shoot and shoot, and then cut and cut and cut and cut and cut. A lot of the time that, so I've focused mostly on wanting to spend time with the administrators, with the teachers, and with the children. The problem is that the principal of this school is very, very focused on doing the right thing by her students. And, obviously she has done that because this school has tested number one, and these are really poor kids. But she's really giving these kids hope. But as a result, that means she's insanely busy. Oh, so Hoxton Hupper says you are articulate. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. So the problem is that this principal is so very, very busy that there is a limited amount of time that we have had to access her and access the teachers. With regard to shooting the kids, you have to get permission slips from the parents. We do have permission slips from many of the parents, but the agreement with the principal is that she gets to take a look at the footage before we release it anywhere, because there's really sort of like this vigilante thing that, or this scare about the internet that's going on with children and child molesters, as if, you know, a child molester is lurking behind every URL and in every chat room on the internet. And certainly that there have been some dangers that children have been exposed to, and obviously those are very unsavory things, and we want to protect the children from those things. But Regina Lynn made a point in an article that she wrote about a year ago in which she said, you know, if you're a pedophile or a child molester, or, you know, basically any other kind of criminal, almost the worst place that you can be is the internet, because you're going to leave footprints everywhere. So many of the technologists who are in our audience, they understand this. They understand this, and they but you know, many of the parents don't understand it. Many of the teachers don't understand it. And so, unfortunately, there is sort of a witch hunt that is going on currently with regard to children. And so, releasing the last footage that is going to come out is the footage of the school, and that's kind of unfortunate. But it's all about working with the principal, releasing footage under her term, letting her have a chance to look at it, making sure that the parents' wishes with regard to their children's visibility on the footage has been taken into account, making sure that we can pixelate if there happens to be a child who was videotaped who we don't have a permission slip for. We have to make sure to pixelate that child. We are going to be releasing footage of the teachers and so forth first. Also, we shot Richard Stallman at this school. We shot Akana Peck, who's a Firefox developer and the author of the GIMP book, who actually is co-teaching a Saturday school class with me on using the GIMP at the school. So we've done some of that. The other problem is that I'm sort of kind of a character in the action, because, you know, I'm involved actively with this school, and my problem is that I can't both be in front of the camera and behind the camera a lot of times. And so, unfortunately, we've just had to say goodbye to a lot of, you know, potential video events, and we're hoping that we can summarize it and make it up later. This is all about answering your question about documentation, though, and We're trying to provide as much documentation as we can, because we feel that it is replicable. The other thing, though, about documentation, the reason that I haven't been too worried about it is that There, a lot. We're not writing on a blank slate, and the real leader here is a guy by the name of Paul Nelson. Paul Nelson, and Paul teaches up in the Portland Public School District at Riverdale High School in Portland, and. Go ahead and Google that, and, you know, Paul can't, he gets a lot of emails, but this is the guy who's really the leader, because anything that we are doing is basically a duplication of something that we have seen elsewhere. So, for example, in Extremadura, Spain, we saw that they were doing something where the teacher can basically grab a hold of the students' desktops, and they can broadcast it to each student. So let's suppose that there is a student who is having problems. Many of the other students will have those same problems. And so the teacher can go ahead and just grab that student's desktop, broadcast it to the other students, and then correct that one student's work and thereby teach the other students at the same time. So there's a guy by the name of Daniel Mizuriki, who's a member of our community. Daniel Mizuriki, and his name is spelled M-I-Z-Y-R-Y-C-K-I. I'll type it into IRC. And Daniel recently made me aware of something called iTalk, and I just put that into the IRC. And that is something that is similar to this. So there's really nothing that we are doing that's really all that unique. I guess the only thing that we are doing that is unique is we're using the analysis of this Harvard business professor by the name of Clayton Christensen, and we said, okay, look, there are people for whom free open source software is good enough. The problem really is that people who are trying to imitate Windows and they're trying to imitate the Mac, well, yeah, I mean, CompHiz is important. Barrel is important. It's really important to have eye candy for people who want that. But the thing that we're overlooking is that there's a lot of people who all they really need is, at least at this point in history, all they really need is access to the Internet. And that's our bread and butter. That's where we can do things that the proprietary companies can't do. And so really the only thing that I ever did that was unique is that I took Christensen's ideas and I applied them to this one individual school, to try to use this one individual school as an example of where we really, I think, should focus our energies, because it's all about the install base. You know, most of the reasons that people use non-free software, the reason they put up with DRM, to the extent they put up with it at all, is because they think that that's their only choice. If they knew that they really had a choice, if we can break the Microsoft business model of leveraging its monopoly for the desktop operating system and for desktop productivity software, then I think we would start to see a lot of real creativity blossom.
I have a question for you.
Go ahead, Dan.
With the introduction of Linux in the schools, one of the things that we've heard time and again for the reason of not going with free software in the schools and sticking with the Microsoft, and particularly the Microsoft Office products, is because, you know, the excuse is that we need to prepare students for the real world, and the real world uses Microsoft Office. Now, obviously, in the case here with the school that you're dealing with, that excuse isn't flying. What do you think of that excuse then, as for why Microsoft has to be used in the school?
Well, you know, the thing about that, that's obviously, we are teaching children to not be trained monkeys. We are teaching children to think. And that's the reason why this school has succeeded the way that it has, because they are teaching children to think. They are not just teaching children to repeat what it is that they, you know, that was being spoon-fed to them. You know, I think that it's important for people to also read a book by Thomas Friedman called The World is Flat. And in his book, The World is Flat, Thomas Friedman identifies 10 trends in history that are leveling the playing field, and he tries to look forward. He calls his, he subtitles his book A Brief History of the 21st Century, and the joke there obviously is, okay, well, the 21st century is just starting. How can you write a brief history of it? You know, and his answer is, well, we're projecting trends forward, and let's, what is the 21st century going to be about? It's going to be about a flat earth. It's going to be about how human beings have overcome some of the limitations of time and space and gravity. And in part, one of the flatteners, one of the 10 flatteners that he's talking about is free open source software. And basically what he's talking about there is that, I mean, if you think about it, if you add up the number of people who live in China and the number of people who live in India, that's 10 times the population of the United States approximately. And as Steve Weber said, genius is randomly distributed throughout the human population. If we believe that we in the English-speaking world have some sort of natural entitlement or some birthright to prosperity and to being the, you know, the innovators of the world, we are going to be really very sadly mistaken. We all know, we've all seen the statistics about how China and India are graduating more engineers annually than the United States is. We have to teach children to think. Teaching people to merely use non-free software is training them only to use that package. And it, that training, first of all, it assumes that the user interface for Microsoft Office is going to be the same at the time these students enter the workforce as it is today. That's demonstrably false. I mean, we all know that the Microsoft Office 2007 user interface is dramatically different from the Microsoft Office user interface of just 7 years ago. So back in 2007, if we thought that the middle school students who were entering the workforce, you know, basically now would be using a GUI like they were using back then, obviously those students would not be prepared if they had only been trained to click on the same buttons in the same places as opposed to thinking about concepts of word processing, concepts of spreadsheets, concepts of how to use presentation software. And so, number one, the GUI is going to change. Number two, we need to teach children to think in order to be able to compete against the geniuses who are going to be leaving the universities in China and India at the time that our students are graduating from middle school. And then, of course, there's the Larry Lessig. Did, you know, I think everybody should also read Larry Lessig's book, The Future of Ideas. In that book, The Future of Ideas, Larry Lessig talks about, and someone says, CG, you sound like you're not a supporter of intellectual design. I mean, if you're referring there to, you know, as opposed to evolution, what is it called, creative? Maybe this guy's talking about something else, I don't know. But so Larry Lessig, I think people should really read Larry Lessig's book, The Future of Ideas, because he talks about the innovative commons. He talks about the tragedy of the anti-commons. The classic example that he gives in that book is At the time that the Soviet Union was collapsing and transitioning to the separate autonomous states that we have today, there were buildings that had been held and owned by the Soviet infrastructure. And the problem, there was a lot of real estate that was standing unused because no one would invest, no one would commit to a lease, or no one would invest in improving these buildings because of the tragedy of the anti-commons. The tragedy of the commons says that if everybody has a right to use a common resource, then it will get degraded rapidly from overuse. Larry Lessig said, well, think about it the reverse way. What about the tragedy of the anti-commons, where if any one person has a right to veto the use of what really should be a common space, we're going to experience a drop in innovation, because innovation oftentimes comes out of a commons. That, as Linus has said, and, you know, he was repeating Sir Isaac Newton's statement in this regard, we all stand on the shoulders of giants. You know, there are very, very few ideas that are completely brand new. So if we are going to give anyone the right to a veto over the use of common space, if we are going to lock down an important platform like Microsoft Office or any desktop office productivity software, if we are going to demand that students just learn how to use one particular GUI, we are going to experience a drop in innovation. And the people in India are not doing this. The people in China are not doing this. They are not allowing themselves to be limited by the intellectual property laws that exist in the United States. And so if we in the United States allow ourselves to continue to be beholden to Microsoft and Microsoft's business partners who are monetizing a dead business model, we are going to find ourselves falling behind the ball. So that's a long way of saying in terms of students should be taught to think. They should be taught to adapt rapidly to a new environment that's placed in front of them.
The times are changing. It's changing, you know, in music and media.
Yeah, that's true, and that's...
Hopefully the patents, you know, software patent system in particular changes. That's an area that really needs to be revised. I mean, you can get a room full of, you know, 20, programmers and tell them to code something, and, there's a pretty good chance that more than one will come back, you know, with something that's very similar to someone else's already done, you know. There's only so many ways, you know, to code up a for loop, you know.
Right. That's right, and so I think that we're going to have to. There's a problem with politics, and there's a problem with economics, and the problem with Larry Lessig has said we need to become more involved in politics. We need to insist on openness and governance, we need to insist on an open internet, and I think that we are strongest. I think we should really focus on where we are strongest. We are strongest where we are free. We're free in cyberspace right now, relatively speaking. I mean, we do have problems with non-free formats. I was having a conversation with Rick Moon. His name is Moen, Rick Moon, the other day on the SV lug list about lockdown formats, and he and I were talking about, there was a really cool video that I'm going to try to find here and post. I've got it bookmarked. There was an event that we did in San Francisco in a low-income benefits association called St. Anthony Foundation, and I'll post a link to this in a second. I'm searching it right now. And basically what we did there was we had I found this here, I'm going to post it. What we did basically was we had gone to St. Anthony's and we did a demo there of we had done a demo for the people at this public benefits agency, and CNET came with a video camera, and they videoed it. And let's see, can someone help me out here? I have somehow managed to close the one of the bars on my Firefox browser. Well, I'm looking at, all I can really see now is just the tabs. I don't have the bar, and I don't know what I have done here to do this. But
did you hit F11 or I think it's F11 to go to full?
I tried that, mode. And I'm toggling F11, and it's I'm getting full screen, but then when it comes back, it's I'm still missing the toolbar, and so I can't paste the URL into the so I'll just be dinking with this. What I have right now are just the tabs, and I'm not seeing the URL.
If you hit the Alt F key, will it open up the file window?
No, that didn't work. Alt F didn't work. But I'll post this. But the point is that Rick Moon was not able to see this video because it's in Flash, and he insists on having no non-free packages at all on his computer. And, you know, I try to not have someone's Control-L, Control-V. Okay, so thanks for that. Control minus L or Control minus V. Okay, so here we go. Let's see. I'll be able to paste this in a second. But the point was that the same point that Larry Lessig is making, which is that we are basically in danger of losing our culture if we can't even show an event that basically is about, it's an event that we, our community hosted, and here it is in the, we can't visualize it because we are, you know, it's using non-free, it's using non-free formats. Now here, wait, I'm going to give this another try. Copy link location. I'm going to try opening this in a different... Let's see if this works. Okay. I think I have it now. This was a really good event. There we go. So your question was about software patents and proprietary formats, and this gets back to why the digital tipping point is being done as much as possible with open source tools and open formats, because it's true that many of the video tools are much better in the non-free world right now for the short term, for the time being, but that means that we're handing off our culture to companies whose business models are adverse to our own goal of freedom in cyberspace, and we just didn't want to go down that path. Andy Updegrove also made a really interesting point recently in which he talked about, and this has to do with the ODF versus OOXML debate. Andy Updegrove said, let's think about the example of the Rosetta Stone or other clay tablets that have endured for 5,000 years. most people today don't really even anticipate that they'll be able to access the same formats in, let's say, 10 years. So they're, you know, many of the big content providers have gotten us to believe that we have to accept the limitation of not being able to access things, files that we purchased, music that we purchased like 5 and 10 years ago. We either have to break the law in North America and do illegal downloading, or we have to pay for music that we have previously purchased. And Andy Updegrove said, you know, we really need to think about permanence. We need to think about data permanence. And this is a really, really big portion of the digital tipping points theme as well. We want people to understand that we cannot go down the road of, here it is, CNET went and videotaped this event that I posted to the IRC channel there. And they did a great job. I mean, they talked about, Ubuntu was front and center. Basically, it was an event where this low-income benefits organization, St. Anthony's, had done a lot of postering and flyering and public outreach to various other organizations in the Tenderloin, which is a very poor part of San Francisco. We had a lot of people come by to get help. They had brought in old computers, and the protagonist in this little film, Paul Woods, is an African-American who comes in with, you know, a computer that had no operating system on it, and Paul had no idea what the deal was, why he couldn't turn his computer on and get it to work. And the guy the Asian guy who's speaking to him with his back to the camera, saying you have to have an operating system on it, he was actually he's part of a company called ReliaTech, and they're mostly a Windows shop, although they're moving more and more to Linux all the time. And we actually did a really good job of collaborating with these Windows people, where if they couldn't help out these people, and many of them they could not because they had, you know, intellectual property issues, we sent them over to us, and we installed, and if you look at that video, you'll see Christian Herman, who's a member of our local Linux user group. Christian's the guy with the Berkeley T-shirt on. And he installs Ubuntu on Paul Wood's computer. And this is a great story. This is a story about how we potentially helped bring this one guy, Paul Woods, you know, into the computer age and give him all the benefit of the world's greatest library ever, the Internet, in his own home, 24/7, 365. And ironically, this story, Rick Moon, who's one of the, you know, deep, long-time, he's got really deep roots in the San Francisco Bay Area free software movement. Rick wasn't able to view that video because he refused to use non-free formats on his computer at home. And that's kind of a shame, and it's something that we have to focus on. And it's combined with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. I think that the greatest threats to our freedom today is these proprietary formats. And that's why, again, the digital tipping point seeks to be a digital tipping point. You know, let's not go stealing music from, you know, like if Madonna doesn't release her, or Britney Spears or any of these other stars, and their record labels don't release that music under a free format and a free license, well, you know, let's just go and patronize people like Trent Reznor of Nine Inch Nails, who was slashed on it, I guess, today or yesterday, for, you know, having made a lot of money for releasing his music under a Creative Commons license. You know, they're going to be able to beat us in many of the legislatures. So let's go where we're best and where we're strongest. Let's just work around them, because this is what the Internet does. This is what free software does. It works around obstacles.
It's awesome that you mentioned that. We're going to play one of those tracks tonight because it's released on the Creative Commons for non-commercial attribution.
Right.
So we're going to play one of those songs on the way out. I was gonna mention that actually myself, but I'm glad you brought it up. It's awesome that there are artists out there in the music industry that are willing to take a chance like that. They see that, you know, if you give something back to the community, that people will embrace you even more. You know, it's too an obvious of a thing. You know, the record companies could say, yeah, you know, if we're going to come out with an album, let's release two songs under Creative Commons. If the people listen to the tracks, they like it, maybe they'll go out and buy the whole record.
Yeah, that's right. And the other thing, one of the guys from the Talking Heads, I'm going to search for this to see if I can find this, David Byrne, I believe his name is, was Slashdotted about 2 or 3 months ago he wrote a really thoughtful article that basically broke down the business model for making music. And he pointed out that there are a lot of different ways to make music. When you sell music, there are, you know, you can do the and he has a name for each of them, and I'll try to find them here if I can. But, free software is about choice. And, you know, I would like to think that people are going to try to use free software and they're going to try to use Creative Commons licenses. But, you know, I think that we should, you know, with all due respect to Richard Stallman, I don't think it's unethical to have non-free software. And I don't think it's unethical to use a full-on copyright license as opposed to a Creative Commons license. But, you know, I just feel sorry for you if you feel like you have to choose that business model, because look at what you'll be missing out on. It's the tragedy of the anti-commons. You know, it's exactly what Larry Lessig was talking about in his book, The Future of Ideas. Basically, the idea is that if we live in an innovation desert, if we live in a world where lockdown prevails, we are not going to be able to keep up with India and China, where they don't place those same kind of restrictions on themselves. And so, you know, their iteration of updates and upgrades and improving their work is going to accelerate much, much faster. So, you know, we have to start thinking of different ways to be able to support the arts. And I saw also on Slashdot the other day that they're in Canada, I believe it is, they're talking about doing something similar to what is done in Germany. Let me talk about Germany, because I'm more familiar with Germany just because I speak German, and because my girlfriend, the co-producer of the film, Dorothy Weiler, is German. And so in Germany, everybody pays for, on a monthly basis, they all pay for what is called a Gebühr, and it's a fee. If you have a TV, you have to pay this fee. And the fee supports basically, you know, there are several different channels, several different public channels, and the fee supports that creative work. The problem is that, or not a problem, but I mean, this is a new era. This is an era in which the old model of someone being able to just go ahead and be Madonna, you know, or even be the Talking Heads, where you're going to go and you're going to create this awesome piece of music and millions of people are going to buy it, and you're going to make millions and millions of dollars from the simple sale of, you know, one record album. That business model is just going away because of the ability and willingness of people to break the law. You know, whether you like the law or not, they're breaking the law. As a matter of fact, it's just not legal to copy music, and we should discourage this. We should discourage people from illegally copying music, because the GPL is based on copyright, and if we expect people to respect the GPL and release their work back to the world, and if we expect people to release the, you know, improvements to the digital tipping point. By the way, I saw that someone on here had already edited some digital tipping point video, and thank you for that. And they said they're going to do something with it. I'd really like it if someone would post that up somewhere and put a link back to it, because that's exactly what we need. But if we expect people to comply with our licenses, we have to basically demand that people comply with the law. I mean, now, I'm not the kind of hard ass that wants to go throwing people into jail, you know, so I don't really have a solution for what do you do with people who break the law. I mean, even though I'm a lawyer, you know, I really kind of don't like suing individuals. I sue big companies as a way of keeping them in line, and so, you know, I'm not a law and order type that is talking about throwing people in jail and stuff, but I mean, really, when you think about it, it's skanky, and you're losing your woofy if, you know, you're not going to have a place in the new economy. If Cory Doctorow is right, and if we're moving to a reputation and attention-based economy, if you're doing illegal shit and, you know, you're going and you're releasing, you're using GPL software and you're not providing the source code for derivative works, well, shame on you, you know, and you know, we should turn our backs on those people, or I don't know exactly how we do we go and sue these people? I don't really have a plan for it, but you know, really shame on you if you're going to go in and not comply with the wishes of the community that's gone and created this GPL software, or if you're not going to comply with the artist's wishes. And coincidentally, by the way, why would you steal Microsoft Windows? Why would you steal Madonna when you can go and get other songs that are free as in beer and free as in freedom? You know, it just doesn't make sense. And why can't we do something like Germany does and get a fee for let's ask everyone who has a computer to pay a fee, or let's ask everyone who has an internet connection to pay a fee for supporting creative works. We've got to rethink it. And unfortunately for the Republicans in our community, and there are a lot of conservatives in our community, and you know, they have contributed a lot to our community. Eric Raymond is conservative. He is a libertarian. I didn't talk with Eric about what he thought about this idea of a gebühr, or a fee for supporting these kind of creative works. But, you know, this is at some point we have to say to the whole group of people, look, you're part of this community. You need to pay. You need to come up with either a monthly fee or some other type of fee, but we've got to subsidize this, because people have to, until the reputation economy really kicks in, until it is the world of Cory Doctorow and Down and Out in the Magic Kingdom, we need to come up with an idea for providing developers who work on the code to be able to make a living, even if they're not working for Google, even if they're not Andrew Morton. You know, maybe there's someone who, like Bill Kendrick, who's in the Linux user group of Davis, who created TuxPaint. You know, Bill's got a job, but, you know, he can't work on TuxPaint during the day because he's got other work that he's doing. And he's got a little boy by the name of William, you know, and he's got a family that he needs to support. And so we should find a way of supporting Bill Kendrick in doing TuxPaint, and we should find a way of supporting. And I think Nine Inch Nails and Trent Reznor is kind of finding a way for that.
Another example is, are you familiar, Christian, with the Ardora, the audio recording software?
Ardora?
Ardora, A-R-D-O-U-R.
Oh, Ardora, yeah. I haven't used it, but I'm familiar with it.
Paul Davis is the main developer of that. He has enough sponsorship by people that he's able to work on it, you know, 100% of the time. And because of that, it's a great piece of software. And he's built a community around it. It's the same idea, you know. People, if there's a piece of software that you like, the free software, open source software, support the developers who work on it. If they're able to do it more devote more of their time to it, the product will get better, you know, and more people will use it.
Yeah, we have to, you know, we have to come up with a way for people to perceive fairness in supporting these creative, innovative, visionary people like Eric Raymond and Richard Stallman and Trent Reznor and Madonna, you know, and I went to a lecture by someone at Harvard who he believed that, I've forgotten the guy's name, I'm sorry, he believes that a tip jar model is not going to work because it's sort of the old story about in New York City, you know, a crime happens on the sidewalk and everybody's looking out their window and, you know, New York's not this way anymore, I understand, but that, you know, everybody looks out their window and nobody does anything because nobody wants to get involved because everybody's afraid of getting involved. And so, in other words, there's a cost, but there's no reward to the individual for participating. And I think it's cool that this developer that you're referring to is being supported and that he has a community. And, you know, that's, I think, another example of the fact that we're transitioning to this woofy-based economy where people will pay for quality. They will pay for, they will support people who are doing a great thing like that. But that's a tip jar model, and I'm not sure that the tip jar model works in all cases. I think
a lot of the cases it doesn't work.
Yeah, a lot of the cases it doesn't work, and we as a community have to really put our minds around the fact that some people are going to, I mean, think about what human beings are. We originated in it's really kind of fascinating actually when you think about we originated in groups of probably no more than 150, and so most of the feelings that we feel today and most of the thoughts that we have today are based on an infrastructure, a basic biology that was shaped somewhere between like 200,000 to maybe 100,000 years ago when we lived in groups of like 25 to 150 in at maximum. And the thing is that there's this constant tension in human communities then and now for between order and diversity. So it's the same thing that we see with regard to the Linux standards base, for example. We want to have everybody on the same page. Ideally, wouldn't it be great if, you know, if we just had one package installer that would be able to work across all these various different packages. And, you know, give the devil his due. What Microsoft did is the same thing that the Romans did, which is that Microsoft established standards. Of course, the problem was that Microsoft did it through brute force and fraud and a lot of underhanded ways of building up their monopoly, and they abused the market, you know, as was proven by several court cases. And the Romans likewise, you know, imposed a Pax Romana on the world, whereby, you know, there was peace, but there was peace because if you stepped out of line, a Roman soldier killed you. And, you know, that's we want to live in a democracy. We don't want to live in that kind of world. And so there's a tension between, on the one hand, wanting to have standards, and on the other hand, wanting to have diversity. Because the problem with standards is that they need to be agreed upon, but they also need to be sufficiently flexible and well designed so that they're not micromanaging things, but they need to be sufficiently detailed and well documented so that people can write standards around it. So the problem is that we evolved during a time when it was maladaptive for humans to live in a community where there were just one or two individuals who were producing, one or two men who were producing most of the children in the society, right? So that's why there has always been this competition. So there's this excellent book that I think people should read called The Red Queen, and I'll search it while I'm, because it really gives an idea of, it helps me understand humanity. The Red Queen, what it basically talks about is that the reason that we see competition, oh, it's by Matt Ridley, The Red Queen, Sex and the Evolution of Human Society, I think is the title of it. Sex and the Evolution of Human Nature. Yeah, so it's called The Red Queen, Sex and the Evolution of Human Nature. And basically what he talks about there is that the code, the DNA, it's funny, it's almost as though the code speaks through us, you know. So here we are in a free software program talking about free software code, but now we're sort of transitioning a bit to talk about DNA code. And, you know, the funny thing about it is that the DNA almost, there's a question as to, am I controlling myself, or does my DNA control who I am? And, you know, obviously there's a little bit of truth to both things, but the thing is that the code wants a couple of things. The code wants diversity, because the way that the code improves is by having just enough diversity such that if it's to prevent a monoculture. I mean, we don't want to have a monoculture in the desktop, and DNA doesn't want to have a monoculture in our own human DNA, because, you know, if a virus sweeps through a code base, you know, this is one of the reasons why free open source software is really not amenable to a lot of viruses, because the malware developers just have a hell of a time coding for all these different package managers, and we're constantly, you know, as soon as an exploit is created, we find the exploit, and, you know, the Firefox exploits are usually closed within 24 to 48 hours, and, you know, and it's because of our diversity, but somehow we have to allow for a business model that will both allow for this diversity, and it will also create standards. I guess I kind of tapered off there at the end.
Christian, you raised some really great points, and I really appreciate you taking the time to talk. The Digital Tipping Point seems to be a fantastic project, and we wish you all the best with it.
Yeah, well, thank you very much. Again, I'd like to put out a request. So I'm just typing in The Red Queen by Matt Ridley. I'd like to, if people feel as though the Digital Tipping Point is worth supporting, please consider helping us out. There's a lot of different ways we could use help. Transcribers, translators. We need someone to watch our wiki. You know, we're putting up all of our transcriptions online for the whole world. You know, so that if people do transcription work for us, if they listen to our video, if you like the video on the Digital Tipping Point archive, you can head over to digitaltippingpoint.com/wiki, look for the transcription catalog. You can transcribe any interviews that you like. Please watch that page. If you see spam on the Digital Tipping Point wiki, you know, please clean it up. You know, and email me, einfeldt@digitaltippingpoint.com. We need rough editors. We need people to step forward and say, yeah, I will trust you, Christian. I'll send you a 500 gig external hard drive. I trust that you will load video onto it and you'll send the video back. I will trust you with, you know, these important interviews. I'll trust that you'll do a good job of editing it, and, you know, and then send it back to me. I'll load it up onto the Internet Archive's Digital Tipping Point video collection so that we can all rip, mix, burn. We also need software developers, someone to help us solve the problem of how are we going to have a version control software, something like Subversion, that's free software for managing this vast body of heavyweight video, this heavy .dv files. So if anyone has any ideas for how they can help us solve those problems, I'm open for it. Again, we need transcribers, translators, animators, software developers, wiki editors to clean up our wiki, and we also need graphic artists and so forth. We also need news editors. You know, send me stories for what you think should go on the Digital Tipping Point front page. It's your video, it's your movie, it's a movie about us, it's a movie about why we're cool, it's a movie about how we have fun. I don't want this to be my movie. I'm not a control freak. I just want to share this video with the world, and let's tell people about ourselves.
Great stuff.
So, well, thank
yes,
you very
yes,
much.
Thank
I guess.
You very much.
Yeah, thank you for letting me rant. I really appreciate appreciate this. You know, I use free software every day, and I want to thank Richard Stallman. I want to thank Linus Torvalds. I want to thank Brian Behlendorf. I want to thank all the other developers out there, because I'm an attorney, and, you know, I use this in my practice every day, and so you guys have helped me feed myself. And this is all about giving back, and I feel real passionate about it, and I'm very grateful to you guys, all of you out there.
We'll have to have you on again in the future.
Yeah, thanks very much. So have a good evening, and I'm just going to hang back here to see how the program ends.
Okay.
No problem.
On to other music items.
Bring that up.
Amazon released its downloader application for Linux, the Linux client. For a while now, since the Amazon Music Store started, they had the Windows and the Mac version, and they finally released the Linux version, which is a good thing, I think. They're making available high quality MP3s with no DRM, which is good. And it's nice that there's an option for Linux users who want to purchase, mainstream music. I mean, personally, I love Magnitude, but it's nice to be able to have the option of buying, a major label artist legally,
Oh, yeah, I hear you.
Well, you could buy them before, you just couldn't play it on your damn machine.
Right.
You know, now you can actually buy it and play it on your machine. So what did you get, Pat?
I bought to
go right out and pick it up and download something. What did you get?
I bought a kid's album for my four-year-old son from Lori Berkner. Anybody who has young kids knows who Lori Berkner is. So I bought an album that had 23 tracks on it for $8.99.
And does your kid like it?
He loves it. High quality MP3s. They sound great, and I could do whatever I want with it.
Yeah, the Amazon downloader, I actually got in on a beta on that and tested it a few weeks ago. And right out of the gate, it worked really, really well for me. And I'm glad to see that they are putting their money where their mouth is. And you know what? Not to jump around on subjects, but speaking of Amazon, one of the things I wanted to ask you, Christian, is if you ever considered looking into using Amazon's S3 service for storage. It's not really the best thing for constant up and back, but, I mean, if you need a quick place to drop some files, I mean, something like 3 cents a gig, really cheap.
Well, thanks. I hadn't thought of that. There are a couple of thoughts that I have about that. Number one is the issue of permanence. Number two is the thought of having to pay, over and over again. So if it's like 3 cents per gig, and a terabyte is 1,000 gigs. So you can see that it starts to get real expensive real quickly when you've got 15 terabytes. The other problem, too, is permanence. The Internet Archive is truly open. It's truly free. It runs on free software. It's a true library, and so our goal is to be able to provide a, you know, source code that will endure, and something that really is free, that, you know, that there's no choke point, because we want this to all persist.
Yeah, you got some points there. I see exactly what you're saying. But just a thought.
Right. I mean, I'm willing to entertain anything, because, you know, maybe we could fundraise for it and so forth. But the problem with, you know, we interviewed Brewster Kahle, who runs the Internet Archive, and he said that he thinks that nonprofits are going to play an increasingly important role because of the importance of innovation commons like the Internet Archive. In order for our society to really develop, we do need free open source software, we do need free libraries, we do need permanence, and it needs to have a business and revenue model that is not depending on individual sales to individual people, because the consumer just doesn't respect that. And, you know, if you have 100 million people, quote, stealing music, well, question, maybe it's not stealing anymore. So we have to find a way to fund it, and I don't know, but so I'm open to all suggestions. Right now, the Internet Archive is really good because it's free, it's large, it's free as in beer, it's free as in freedom, they get it. But it's not a place where we can store .dv files, not yet, at any rate.
All right.
Just a couple of quick things regarding Nine Inch Nails. The album is 36 tracks, and they're in groups of four. You can download the first 9 tracks off of BitTorrent for free, DRM-free MP3s, in high quality. They also have a $5 download option, and they also have a $10 two CD set. They also had a $300 Ultra Deluxe Limited Edition package that they were limiting to 2,500. They sold out of that, so basically they've made $750,000 within the first day by doing this.
Wow.
Right. And that just, I mean, that really, that shows that free really is, I mean, Chris Anderson has this book coming up that's going to be called Free, and he has this article on Wired that is called Free, and he makes some really good points there about the power of free. And I, again, to come back to Cory Doctorow, not to worship him too much or anything, but I think really Cory captured it with his book Down and Out in the Magic Kingdom. I think that gives us an idea of what the world is going to be like.
What, Pat, what did you get for the $300?
I'm not exactly sure what's in the deluxe $300 set. I didn't look into it. But they sold out.
Come with a clone of Trent Reznor himself for $300.
Yeah. Trent's going to come
That's
over
right. they,
and give you
they
a photo challenge.
They better have a little bit of Trent Reznor's spit in there or something.
Yeah, holy mackerel. That's an expensive free.
Yeah.
That's really cool.
So I'm going to be posting right now to the IRC the link to Chris Anderson's article in Wired about free and how free is going to change. And really, it's amazing the timing, because it came out right before the Nine Inch Nails announcement, this article.
That looks pretty cool.
Yeah, that $300 package has a whole bunch of stuff, like all the recordings in WAV files, a Blu-ray disc with extremely high-resolution audio, a book containing 48 pages of photographs. So I guess for people that are like diehard fans, it's the way to go. And they it was successful. Like, people bought it, so.
Cool. Hey, Linksifer, you have anything you want to say this week?
Linksifer.
Nope. Read my blog.
Right. Then we'll see you in
about 3 months.
I don't
get to talk here anymore, so, you know, if you want to know what's going on with me, read my blog.
I don't know, he's starting to sound like Dvorak over there. Read my blog. Come on, read my blog.
Dun, dun, dun. All right, I guess we got to start wrapping it up there.
Yep.
I tell you to read Alan's blog, too, but he doesn't ever post anything.
Yeah, see, he posts quarterly.
Yeah, quarter's coming up. You'll get
it's
something.
It's coming up on the second quarter. We ought to have a post pretty soon. Yeah.
I think next week I really want to get the wife on to talk about her Triple E PC, but she wasn't feeling well tonight. But because I know Gorkon was whining and crying last week about that. So we're going to make him wait another week.
So I just put up on the IRC channel, I just put up a link to David Burns' article in Wired Magazine called David Burns' Survival Strategies for Emerging Artists and Megastars. He does a great job of really breaking down the different business models and where people can go. And the same business model applies to the digital tipping point. It applies to a lot of content. And so for those of us who want to know how Cory Doctorow's world of Down and Out in the Magic Kingdom might come about and how we make the transition to the Woofy Society, David Byrne's article gives us a little bit of a transition.
We'll check that out. Thanks for the link.
All right. We have John O'Bacon next week as a guest, yes?
Yes.
That should make Joel McLaughlin or Gorkon very happy.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, we'll get to hear his boyfriend yet a second time. And, alright, that's it. We got a Trent Reznor song. Or is it Trent Reznor or is it Nine Inch Nails or is it one and the same?
Probably one and the same.
Alright, Three Ghosts. Is that I or one?
It's from the first group of songs, track number 3.
Okay, track number 3, Three Ghosts, one. I want to thank you, Christian. Thank you, Link, Alan, Pat.
Thank you, everybody.
Yeah,
thanks for listening, everybody.
Thanks for allowing me to rant.
Hey, no problem. Thank you. It was great, and we look forward to more good stuff from you, and we'll get you back on in the future.
Cool.
And with that, I'm going to play us out of here with Trent Reznor, Nine Inch Nails, Three Ghosts.
Yeehaw. Good night, everybody.
So we can paint anything we want?
Anything at all.
How about if I paint your fine ass? Yeah, with my tongue brush.
Tongue brush.
Shut up. Just shut up. It's over.
Yeah. You know, before we go, just not to end on a sad note, but two little pieces of bad news this week. One, on March 4th, E. Gary Gygax passed away.
Oh, the D&D guy, right?
Yeah, he was probably the biggest and most influential co-creator of Dungeons & Dragons. Did a heck of a lot for role-playing and gaming in general. And also today, Patrick Swayze came out as he's been diagnosed with pancreatic cancer, and it's pretty bad. Only has about a month to live. So,
two icons.
Yeah, two icons. I have some bad news with them. But I don't know. Alan's still got to drive to work tomorrow.
Yes, and with that, I have to say goodnight to y'all.
Good night, Al.
It's getting late. I'll talk to you all next week. Good night, everybody.
Night, Al.
Good night.
Good night, Al.
And Alan still, Link has to ride the train to work. You still there, Link?
I guess he dropped off.
Pat, you have to ride to work tomorrow, too.
Actually, I'm taking a day off tomorrow.
You stink. I stink. Where? Oh. Everybody stinks. Yeah, you don't stink. Anyway, thank you for coming on, Christian, and
sure.
We'll talk to everybody next week. Have a happy.
Take care, everybody.